Well, here we are in our new abnormal. Hopefully it won't last too long. But I don't know if you noticed in the first few lines of that song that we just played, where they said, as we wait for the promise of old. And we have to wonder, what is that promise? Because there's a lot of reference to the promises. There's hymns based on that particular theme. But what exactly is it? How important is the promise to the overall plan? And especially, what exactly is that promise? It began, like that particular song said, it began a long time ago. We can read of the beginning of that promise back in Genesis chapter 15. And this is a subject that I've covered before, but it was many, many years ago. But I think it's important that we understand, because this chapter has more to do with these days than we might realize. In Galatians 3:29, the Apostle Paul says, if you be Christ's, then are you Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. What was he talking about? Because he's saying that we are the children of Abraham if we are the children of God. But the promise was what? It all began shortly after an invasion of the Jerusalem-Jericho area, where an alliance of kings came down and swept through the area and captured a number of towns in the Dead Sea area. Abraham raised an army himself and went and caught up with this band of invaders and got all the people back and the spoils that they took. This was Abraham. He raised an army. An army strong enough to overcome an invading force. The scriptures don't tell us much about that particular battle. It must have been an interesting story to tell. But afterwards, the spoils were divided with the people who accompanied him on this particular military campaign. I'm going to pick it up in, let's see, well, it's almost the entire 14th chapter. We got time, let's do that. Let's start in chapter 14. And it came to pass, this is Genesis 14, and it came to pass in the days of Ramphael, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinah, king of Admath, and Shebemer, king of Zebulim. That ain't easy to read with these glasses. And the king of Bela, which is Zoar. And all these were joined together in the valley of Siddim, which was in the Salt Sea area. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and the 13th year they rebelled. And in the 14th year came Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth, Karnaim, and the Zunims in Ham, and the Emims in Sheba Kirathaim. And the Horites in their Mount Seir unto El Paran, which is by the wilderness. And they returned and came to En Mishpat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites that dwelt in Hazion Tamar. And there went out the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar. And they joined battle with them in the valley of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and with Tidal, the king of nations, and Aramphel, the king of Shinar, and Arioch, the king of Elazar, for four kings against five. And the valley of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there. And they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went their way. And they took Lot, Abraham's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And there came one that had escaped and told Abraham the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner. And these were confederate with Abram. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born of his own house, 318. Abram was no small operation, apparently. 318 servants, and pursued them unto Dan. And he divided himself against them, and he and his servants by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hubba, which is in the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer, and of the kings that were with him, at the valley of Shaveh, which is the king's dale. And Melchizedek, here's where it begins to get interesting, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. And he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand." And he gave him tithes of all. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, "Give me the persons, and take the goods to yourself." And Abraham said unto the king of Sodom, "I have lift up my hand unto you, unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abraham rich,' save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion." So that's the setting for this particular engagement. And take note of the fact that the king of Melchizedek brought forth bread and wine. That's a reference that will have some significance in just a few minutes here. Now, chapter 15. This introduces the events that are key to God's plan for humanity. Let's continue in chapter 15. "After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abraham in a vision, saying, 'Fear not, Abraham, I am your shield and your exceeding great reward.' And Abraham said, 'Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus?' Abraham saying, 'What does it matter how much you bless me? I've got no heir to leave it to.'" He's getting on in years. And Abraham said, verse 3, "Behold, to me you have given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir." And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, "This shall not be your heir, but he that shall come forth out of your own bowels shall be your heir." And he brought him forth abroad and said, "Look now toward heaven and tell the stars, if you be able to number them." And he said unto him, "So shall your seed be." That's pretty remarkable for a man as old as he was, to know that his lineage was going to be so vast they couldn't even be numbered. And this is a man who has no children at this point in time. Verse 6, here's a key. "And he believed in the Lord, and the Lord counted it to him for righteousness. And he said unto him, I am the Lord that brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit it. And he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? Abraham saying, Look, I hear you, but how do I know that what you're telling me is true? In verse 9, we begin to look into a very significant and a very unusual ceremony. There's only a couple of places in the Bible that I know of that present something like this. But this one is particularly significant because of who it's made with and when it's being made. The instructions that Abram was given was right here in verse 9. And he said unto him, "Take me an heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon." We'll come back to those details in a few minutes here. "And he took unto him all these, and divided them in the midst, and laid each piece one against the other, but the birds he divided not." This particular ceremony is what is known as a maledictory oath. It's highly unusual, it's highly significant, and in this case, it's enormously prophetic. Most people read over this passage and don't have a clue as to what it's really talking about. What they would do in this kind of a sacrifice is they would take these particular animals and they would divide them in half, and they would lay one half on one side of the path and the other half on the other, sort of mirror image. I'm thinking they're going to cut these animals in half lengthwise and lay them side to side. Three significant animals here. A heifer, which is kind of a bovine animal, a she-goat, and a ram. Now to do that, it's important to realize that would result in a very bloody path. This ceremony involves blood. And of course, the two birds, they didn't divide in that manner. They were killed by breaking their necks, laying one on either side of the path. When did this happen? From this particular account, we aren't told when it happens, but in a few chapters later, we're going to find out when this was. What was the calendar date of this event? We can know. We have Moses' own account for it. So he laid out the animals, like it says in verse 10, and then he waited, and he waited, and he waited some more. The whole day went by. They waited long enough to where the vultures were circling, and they began to come down upon the carcasses, and Abraham had to drive them away. So we know that was in daylight. Vultures don't fly at night. And verse 12 confirms it even more. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abraham, and lo, an horror of great darkness fell upon him. What does that coincide with? We'll discuss that in a few minutes. And in verse 13, and he said unto Abraham, know of a surety that your seed shall be a stranger in the land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards they shall come out with great substance. That is a prophecy of the Exodus. So now we have some sense of the time frame. Not the whole story just yet. Verse 14. And also that nation, verse 15. And you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall come here again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. So these people who are going to come out of their captivity are going to come back to that location again. This is a prophecy. But it's a prophecy with many, many dimensions, as we'll see here. I keep referring to the good stuff that's coming. Hold on. Verse 17. Picture this. Now this is after dark. Okay? The sun had gone down. That's in verse 12. So this is in the early hours of darkness of the next day. Days begin and end at sunset. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp passed between those pieces. So the smoking lamp, which represented something, and smoking furnace represented something, and the burning lamp represented something. Those two devices passed between those pieces. They walked that bloody path. I'm posing to you that the smoking furnace refers to God the Father, who couldn't be seen in the darkness except as the burning lamp exposed him to view. Does the Son reveal the Father? That's what happened here. What I'm saying is, verse 17 tells us that representatives of two beings appeared to Abraham in this vision. And it's not just a vision, it's a reality that passed between those sacrificial animals laying on either side of the path before the covenant was made with Abraham. Now, it's important to understand about a maledictory oath. It's a kind of covenant made between two individuals. And in this case, it's God who's making the covenant. But this kind of covenant says, if I fail to keep my promise, I will give up my own life. It's that serious. I'm sure Abraham understood that. In the custom of the day, that would have been known. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto your seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. This was the covenant that God made with Abraham. Now let's understand some things of what we just read. As Paul said, if we are Christ's seed, then we are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. We are heirs of this very promise that was given to Abraham there in the environs of Jericho some 430 years before the Exodus. Now, how do we know when this was? Keep in mind, we had a bread and wine ceremony the night before. The covenant was made the night following. And if we go to Exodus 12, we can see the fulfillment of the promise or the prophecy that was made to Abraham that his descendants would spoil their captors and come to that place some 400 plus years later. Let's read in Exodus 12. And the Lord spoke unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak you unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the 10th day of this month, they shall take to them every man a lamb according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for an house. We know what ceremony that was. We observed the modern day equivalent of it the night before last. That was referring to the Passover. And in the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of souls. Every man according to his eating shall make your count for the lamb. We know the rest of the story. They're to take the lamb, they're to take the blood and strike the doorpost and the lintels. Verse 11, you shall eat it with your loins girded and your shoes on your feet and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste, or some versions say in trepidation, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night and will smite all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both men and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. He's telling them how to keep the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. Verse 15. Yeah. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread, and even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. For whosoever eats leavened bread from the first day unto the seventh day, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. And in the first day there shall be a holy convocation. That's today. And in the seventh day there shall be another holy convocation. To you no manner of work shall be done in them, save that which every man must eat. That only may be done of you. And you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for in this selfsame day I have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore shall you observe this day in your generations by an ordinance forever. I just passed over a key word there. I don't know if you noticed what it was. It was the word, the selfsame day. What does that mean? That term is fairly unique in the Old Testament. What is the selfsame day? It's not the same as the same day. We could say that the airplanes hit the Twin Towers in New York and the Pentagon on the same day. That would mean two things happened on the same day. But the self-same day carries a very different connotation. The selfsame day refers to some sort of anniversary. It's not the same as same day. There's other words that say same day. But selfsame day is different. The selfsame day gives us the sense that it is an anniversary of something that happened in the past. So when it says this selfsame day, referring to the first day of unleavened bread, that reflects back to what we just read in Genesis 15. These days of unleavened bread coincide with the giving of the Abrahamic covenant, or the making of the Abrahamic covenant 430 years before. The term selfsame day is used in the Old Testament only 11 places. And in some of them, it's very obvious that it's referring to an anniversary of some sort. The 11 places, in the Hebrew word is gezem. Gezem is translated the selfsame day in Genesis 7:13, Genesis 17:23 and 26, Ezekiel 41, verse 1, 40, verse 1. Exodus 12:17, Exodus 12:41 and 51, Leviticus 23:14 and 21, Deuteronomy 32:48, and the last time in Joshua 5:11. Now Joshua 5:11 is interesting because it also ties this whole thing together. Let's look quickly at Joshua 5:11. Where it says, "And they did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes and parched corn, in the selfsame day." So now we've got a three-way tie here. They entered the land in advance of the Passover season. They ate of the produce of the land that they had just entered on the morrow after the Passover. And that's telling us that this morrow after the Passover is the selfsame day. It's that same selfsame day. Today is the selfsame day, the anniversary of the Exodus, the beginning of the Exodus, and the end of the Exodus, and of the Abrahamic covenant being made between God and Abraham. Now, if you've done any research on this, you'll notice that the same word, getzem, is translated differently in most cases. In fact, the vast majority of the cases, it's translated in another manner. And strangely, what it's mostly translated as is the word bones. What's the connection between bones and anniversary? The translators could tell from the context which translation to use. Because when they saw it was referring to a calendar date, then obviously it's talking about an anniversary. But if it's not talking about a calendar date, they would translate it as bones. Why? Simple reason. Bones are the evidence of something that once was. When you see skeletal remains, you know that this person or this animal had lived in the past. Has nothing to do with a date per se. It's just evidence of something that once was. And that's the subtle difference in how to translate the word. But when we see self same day, that is an indication to us that this is talking about an anniversary event, something that happened on the same day on the calendar at some point in the past. Didn't you see the sense of that? So when we see the term the self same day, we begin to realize that this is talking about something that had happened in the past. So the Abrahamic covenant was made on what we understand to be the evening beginning the first day of unleavened bread. In other words, the night to be much observed. Now we can begin to understand why that day is so important, or why that particular evening is so important. Two representatives of the two being Godhead passed between those sacrificed animals down this bloody path, and a covenant was made with Abraham that his seed would be as vast as the stars in heaven. But there was a promise that went with that, that was more than just his descendants. Reading it, we might see the physical blessings or the physical promise, but implicit with that is also the spiritual aspect of it, which is what Paul is referring to, that if we are Christ's seed, now Christ is the true heir. There's a place where Paul says that. Christ is the true heir of Abraham. But if we are Christ's seed, then we're Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. That promise that was made to Abraham of the blessings that would come to his progeny refers more to us, his spiritual seed, than it ever did to his physical seed. Now, in reference to this, Paul makes the case that adding the law doesn't diminish the promise. Galatians 3, verse 17. This is important. And it's going to be important as I explain the meaning of each of these offerings that were made. Galatians 3, 17. I'm going to start in verse 15. Brethren, I speak after the manner of men, though it be but a man's covenant, yet if it be confirmed, no man disannuls or adds to it. Once a covenant is made, it's solid. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made, he says, not unto the seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ. And that sort of explains what I just quoted earlier, that Paul says a few verses later, that being Christ's seed, we become Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. And this I say, that the covenant that was confirmed before of God in Christ, the law, which was 430 years after, cannot disannul, that it should make the promise of none effect. So the legal system that existed in one of the phases of God's plan does not in any way diminish or annul the promise. Verse 19, what purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator. Now a mediator is not a mediator of one, but God is one. Let's get the picture here of what's happening. And the picture is revealed, I think, through the symbols that God instructed Abraham to offer. He was to take a bovine animal, a heifer, of 3 years old. He gives an age. A she-goat of 3 years old. And a lamb of 3 years old. Each of these would be in their reproductive prime. But then he comes to the dove, on which there's no age given, and a young pigeon. A young pigeon is not yet up to a reproductive age. We were canoeing once, and we passed under this bridge, and there were pigeons up on the ledge under the bridge running back and forth, and we thought that we could scare them off, and come to find out, these were fully fledged. They looked just like adults, but they couldn't fly. These were young pigeons. They looked just like their parents, but they're not quite old enough. That's how you tell a young pigeon. They're not ready to fly. They're not really fully matured yet. Now, there's significance to the symbolism. What do each of these represent? And when we understand what they represent, we're given an amazing picture of God's overall plan for His working with humanity, with His creation. The heifer represents the patriarchal era, the time before Mount Sinai. The she-goat represents the nation of Israel during the Old Testament era, let's call it. The lamb represents the Christian era from the time of Christ's resurrection through to His second coming. So where does that leave the dove and the young pigeon? Now, the blood sacrifice ended with the lamb. There was not a blood sacrifice after that. Abram didn't divide the birds except physically to put one on one side and one on the other. But he did not kill the birds with a knife like he did the other animals. What does that picture? I would say it pictures the millennial era, where two kinds of people are going to be living together. The dove representing the converted spirit-born saints, and the young pigeon representing those people who are becoming converted during the millennial age. The age of the dove is unspecified because by this time, as immortal spirit beings, they're ageless. There'd be no way to describe them. When we're composed of eternal spirit, in a sense, we become eternal, even though we may have a transition date from the physical into the spiritual. Our transition begins from conversion while we're yet in the flesh. But I'm posing to you that that's what those represent. In other words, God has, through this Abrahamic covenant, revealed His master plan for all time. From the patriarchal era clear through to the end of the millennium. That's what those represented. That tells us that the Abrahamic covenant carries through all time, even to the modern day, which Paul is affirming here. We're heirs according to the promise made to Abraham, and that promise is contained in and posed by the Abrahamic covenant. Does that make sense? God is revealing His plan for all time in this one basic scene that we read of in Genesis 15. This event occurred on the selfsame day, the anniversary. It wasn't an anniversary at the time of the Abrahamic covenant, but all of the repetitions of it were. What happened on that day? Well, we have the Abrahamic covenant that occurred on the morrow after what we could take to be the Passover when Melchizedek brought forth bread and wine. A clue as to what's to happen in the future. Then we have the Exodus, which began during the darkness hours. They went out of Egypt by night on the morrow after the Passover. And what is it, Numbers? I don't have that written down. I think it's Numbers 33. Let's see if I can find that. Numbers 33 or Numbers 30, which is it? 30. Yeah, Numbers 33, verse 1. These are the journeys of the children of Israel, which went forth out of the land of Egypt with their armies under the hand of Moses and Aaron. And Moses wrote their goings and out according to their journeys by the commandment of the Lord. And these are their journeys according to their goings out. And they departed from Ramesses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the morrow after the Passover. So we know for sure that the Exodus began what would have been last night, carrying on all through the night as they left under a full moon. We had a beautiful full moon last night that illuminated the way sufficiently where they departed from Egypt by night. That occurred exactly 430 years, the 430th anniversary of the covenant made with Abraham there in that place. But that wasn't the end of it. Because, you see, they entered the promised land after 40 years. And they didn't have to rely on manna anymore because the area that they were moving into was in an area that just had first ripe grain. And they began to eat the grain of the land, after which they didn't need manna anymore. So manna ceased after they ate the produce of the land. Whether it was grain in storage or whether it was freshly harvested grain, not the point. The point was, the Exodus effectively ended on the selfsame day, the morrow after the Passover. What happens to end that period of time? What we call the Old Covenant. We have the patriarchal time. We have the Abrahamic covenant. We have the Old Covenant. We have the New Covenant. What happens to end the Old Covenant? It was Christ's death and burial. The blood sacrifice ended at the cross. We don't need a blood sacrifice anymore. From this point onward, or from that point onward, the Old Covenant ended and the New Covenant began. He actually was introduced the previous evening at Passover. This cup is the New Covenant in my blood, he says. Christ was put into the tomb just as this selfsame day was beginning. So in observing the night to be much observed, we're also observing Christ's burial, which begins a key period of time, the 3 days and three nights that he was in the tomb, to achieve a legal death at that time. It was only after 3 days dead that they were declared legally dead. So that's another thing that occurred on the night to be much observed. So we have all of these things that occur on this selfsame day. The Abrahamic covenant lasted for a span of about 430 years, represented by the heifer. And that represented the patriarchal age. It offered blessings and the promise to mankind, Abraham's descendants, a vast number of people in the world. Then we had the Sinai covenant, what we call the Old Covenant. That was in effect for a span of some 1,525 years, represented by the female goat. What could represent Israel more effectively than a female goat? We know the nature of a goat. Well, that established the nationhood of Israel. That established the religion of Israel. It formally introduced the law in a structured form and gave a consciousness of sin. It brought a nation into and under the promises made to Abraham. The blessings of Israel would have been vast had they been obedient, but they weren't. It gave them the guidance for righteous living. And it added a series of laws that emphasized what needed to be done about sin. The world didn't have that in such a structured manner before, and certainly a nation didn't have it. But God gave that to the nation of Israel. That was what was brought to them under the old covenant. And now we have the new covenant, which is going to be effective for a span of approximately 2,000 years, represented by a male lamb. That establishes the church age. It established the way to true righteousness with the addition of God's Holy Spirit, which national Israel didn't have. Individuals might have, select individuals might have had God's Spirit, as we do, but the people, by the majority, did not. But it expanded the promises to a broader ethnicity. Now Gentiles could come under the promise made to Abraham. And another thing that the new covenant added was they offered a true and full remission of sins and the inclusion into the family of God. And we will soon have what we would know as the millennial covenant. For another 1,000 years beyond this, another 1,000 years plus a generation. And that's what the dove and the young pigeon represent. People of two different types, spirit beings and physical beings, hopefully with the physical beings becoming converted. But they represent the situation in the millennial age. It illustrates a righteous administration and opens the opportunity to all of humanity. In the millennial age, the spiritually undeveloped will have the best environment possible for attaining acceptable righteousness. They themselves will have the possibility of becoming children of Christ and His bride. But keep in mind, the blood sacrifices ended with the Lamb. So all of these things happened on the selfsame day. The Abrahamic covenant was given, the beginning of the Exodus, the end of the Exodus, the end of the Sinai covenant with Christ's burial. And it's interesting, in John 19:30, he says something, and I think we pass over this a little too casually. John 19:30. We'll start in verse 28. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, I thirst. Now there was a vessel full of vinegar, and they filled a sponge with vinegar and put it upon hyssop and put it to his mouth. What else was hyssop used for? When Jesus therefore had received the vinegar, he said, It is finished. And he bowed his head and gave up the ghost. His last words were, It is finished. What was finished? What exactly was finished? Have we thought about it? We tend to think of it only as his sacrifice. It became finished with him being the true Passover. It started with the Passover, and it ended with the true Passover. 1950 years elapsed between the first and his Passover that he observed with his disciples. God's holy days, in addition to this example, God's holy days are revelatory, I guess we could say. Where are the holy days in the overall scheme of things? Well, important events happen on holy days. The promise was uttered on what would become Passover. The Abrahamic covenant was made on what would become the first holy day of the religious season, the first day of unleavened bread. The Exodus began on the first day of unleavened bread, the same. The end of the Exodus occurred on the same anniversary. The finishing of fully implementing the plan of redemption. In other words, when Christ said it is finished, at that point it now became possible to implement full redemption. It wasn't possible before. This final act had to be fulfilled. Giving of the Holy Spirit was on the day of Pentecost, another annual holy day. All of the important events of the redemptive process are tied to God's holy days. They reveal his plan. The Pentecost was also the anniversary of the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. That too was Pentecost. The law was given, and then later the Spirit was given on an annual holy day. Christ's resurrection, he being the true wave sheaf offering, ascended to his Father on Wave Sheaf Day, he being the true wave sheaf. So what have we learned? Well, God's plan is woven throughout his commanded holy days. God's plan is revealed through the covenant made with Abraham, which did not end. It's still ongoing. The old covenant with the nation of Israel was a carry-on of the Abrahamic covenant. It didn't replace it. It was a part of it. But it was a new phase that was developed. The new covenant added another dimension on top of the previous. He's building and building to a conclusion. That's revealed in the Abrahamic covenant, the account that we just read in Genesis 15. God speaks to his own in what we could call coded messages. It's not plain in every case. It's not flat out and clear. Anyone who studied the Bible realized you have to study, you have to compare. This relates to that. When you put the two together, you've got something. Some of us are online or accessing what's called QAnon. All right, I admitted it. But QAnon writes in code. What he's writing is probably very accurate, but it's left wide open to interpretation. It's the interpretation that's unreliable. But the point is, he writes in code. God does too to his people. What he's written is accurate, but we have to come to understand it. We need here a little, there a little. We need to put it together, and we need his Spirit to help us to understand what is really being revealed. And I hope today's message breaks open some of that coded information. When we have God's Spirit, we are especially endowed to understand the plan. Studying to be approved unto God includes comprehension. It's not just an intellectual exercise. God's holy days, his covenants, are revelatory. So I hope from these things we can better understand, that we can better comprehend the full picture of what God is doing.